Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet the winner of the 2013 and V-Zero Award for Young Readers Literature given by the Tulsa Library Trust. Two-time Newbery Honor Book winner Jim Murphy strives to make history come alive in over 30 nonfiction books for children and young adults. In those books, Murphy has tackled the Civil War, the Colonial and American Revolution, the Western expansion, disasters, and medical history through his storytelling techniques of combining traditional narrative with personal histories. For example, one of his best-known books, The Long Road to Gettysburg, tells a story through the writings of two participants, a young 18-year-old Confederate officer, Lieutenant John Dooley, and a 15-year-old Union Corporal, Thomas Galway. Across America on an Immigrant Train uses the 1879 cross-country trip of Robert Louis Stevenson as a backdrop. Murphy's other notable books include An American Plague, the true and terrifying story of the yellow fever epidemic of 1793, The Great Fire, about the Chicago Fire of 1871, and his most recent books are The Giant and How He Humbugged America, about the Cardiff Giant and P.T. Barnum, and Invisible Microbe, Tuberculosis and the Never-Ending Search for a Cure. Jim Murphy will receive the Zero Award Friday evening at 7 o'clock for a presentation at Gilcrease Museum and speak Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at the Hardesty Regional Library. Jim Murphy is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Jim Murphy, welcome to Studio Tulsa and congratulations on the Zero Award.
Well, I'm very honored to have been given the award and looking forward to being out there in Oklahoma.
I'm always interested when I talk to writers for young adults and younger readers. Was that always your intended audience, or was it that your writing naturally had an appeal to young readers?
I think I kind of fell into it more than I planned to write for them. When I was in college, I wandered over. I went to Rutgers University, and there was Rutgers Press, and someone said, "You should go over and talk to the man who, like, runs it." And I wandered in one day and just walked up to his office and went to his secretary and said, "Oh, I'd like to see Mr. Sloan." And she said, "Well, you need an appointment." And I kind of went, "Oh," I had no clue. I was a dopey freshman. And the interesting thing is this man named William Sloan came buzzing out of his office, kind of said, "Come on in and talk with me." And he had been the president of Holt Publishing, and now he was running Rutgers Press. And he was just fascinated that he had been there for like 10 or 15 years already, and no undergraduate had ever come in saying they wanted to be in publishing. I was the first one. He was the nicest guy, and he gave me the keys to the building because he said he had this huge library, and he said, "Start reading." And one of the things he did is he talked to me about all the different areas of publishing there were. And he also hooked me up. For instance, he got me to go to the, at that time it was the Radcliffe Publishing Procedures course, and now it's, I think it's in Columbia University, and also a writer's conference, the Breadloaf Writers Conference. And he got me, you know, invitations to go there, and so he sort of helped educate me about publishing. And the long and the short is, when I came out of college, when I finally graduated, I had decided that I loved the visual aspects of children's book publishing, so I actually went into children's books, became a little assistant editor at a place, and stayed there for almost 7 years, and then eventually decided that I was helping all these other writers create books, and so why didn't I give it a try? So when I was about 26 or 7, I quit that job and became a writer, and that's how I ended up as a children's book writer.
Well, and the first couple of books were as interesting because there was a gimmick to the concept, which was basically going to the patent office and researching mm-hmm. some of the most unusual patents and writing a book about some of these unusual patents, and including the illustrations. Again, getting back to that idea that you love having that illustration to demonstrate the story, and asking kids to guess what they were.
Well, Weird and Wacky Inventions, yes, it was meant to be a guessing game, and it was meant to be fun, but there's real history in there. You know, I did go to the patent office and kind of poked around and had great fun. This is, you know, you could still go into the stacks where they had the actual patents all just piled up. And I literally would have an idea and say, "Okay, what happens when you have bellows?" And so then I went and looked up the patents for bellows and realized that at some point they actually went from pushing air out to pulling air in, and they became vacuum cleaners. yeah. And I just thought that was fascinating, and that kids might get a kick out of that kind of evolution of an invention. And so, yes, it was a bit of a gimmick, but, you know, it seemed to catch a lot of kids' fancy, and it was a very easy way to talk about history. So we worked in I worked in as much history as I could without making it too heavy-handed.
One of the things I really like about your books is the fact that you are tackling history, which is such an oft-maligned subject among kids. And a lot of times that goes to the teaching. They think it's dates and facts, when history is really storytelling, which is something every kid experiences, because, you know, history is what your friends did over the weekend as well as what Washington did when he crossed the Delaware.
Right, right. I mean, one of the things that happened is my books have evolved also. And the earlier ones were much more straightforward and much more traditional in some ways. But I did a book that virtually no one has ever read, this book called, it's a history of tractors. And I remember writing this book and being very enthusiastic, and I was chatting with my dad, and I'm telling him all about this. And I'm, you know, just imagine me. I haven't had a lot of books published, and it's exciting. And I finished the manuscript. I revised it. I sent in all the illustrations, and I'm very happy about it. So I'm telling him, and at one point he leans back and he goes, "Jimmy, that's going to be a big hit in Russia." And I remember kind of laughing because my father had this great sense of humor. And then I went home and panicked and said, "He's right. Who's going to care about this?" And then I thought about it for a second, and I said, "I have to make this thing a little different than usual." And I went back to my notes, and I discovered that most of the, and they were mostly men, who invented early tractors were also crazy as a loon. They just were nuts. And I realized... Well, of course, you'd be nuts, too, if every time you invented a steam tractor, you know, it blew up at some point, and there was lots of explosions and things. So I decided to put in lots of little bits, not a lot, but quotes that they had left behind about their work and things about the tractors blowing up and stuff. And the weird part is that book came out, and it got starred reviews, and people just said, "These are just weird and unusual people, and while tractors don't really excite a lot of people, these people are interesting because they're working against all these odds and they have a sense of humor about it." And from that time on, I decided, you know, I have to put in lots of quotes. I have to make sure that the people involved become the stars versus what they're actually doing.
And that's certainly been the approach in all of your books, from the subjects that every kid's going to learn about in school to a lot of subjects that it might be a line in their history text, like the Great Fire, about the Chicago Fire of 1871, or perhaps the Great Blizzard of 1888. These are little footnotes to history, and yet you make them come alive through these personal accounts.
Well, first with the Great Fire, I was, and my wife and I were in a barn that had thousands upon thousands of old books, and we were wandering around this, and we loved that, and they were very inexpensive. And I was on the top of this, and this barn, by the way, was nothing more than a fire trap. I mean, you couldn't walk anywhere without bumping into piles of old, dry books. And I happened to spot two books together that had the same binding, so I grabbed one, and it was called Chicago and the Great Conflagration, and it was what amounted to an instant history of the fire. It was over 600 pages long. It had been published not more than a month to 2 months after the actual fire. And it had these wonderful illustrations, before and after illustrations of the buildings. And so I just grabbed it and bought it, and it cost $16 or something like that. And I brought it home, and like, I don't know, 6 months later, I'm glancing through it and realize that in the middle there are these personal accounts of people who survived the fire. And I started reading them, and they were very interesting, including one from a person who might be considered a cub reporter who actually was there when the fire started. He was within two blocks when the real big fire started. And I realized, why don't I do a book that narrates the fire using the voices of survivors? So, of course, then I had to hunt out other voices because I wanted to follow this step by step as it ate up Chicago. And then I realized it's an opera. It's a gigantic opera where there's big fire is the backdrop, and all these people are just trying to survive. But as I do the research, I'm also thinking, what are the bigger themes of this? And I realized, okay, you know, part of this was just complete hubris. The, you know, Chicago thought it was indestructible. They thought they were one of the powerhouses of the entire North America, and then they just caught fire and burned up, and clearly that notion didn't help them. They didn't have the infrastructure ready, and all of their safety measures failed. The water system, for instance, at one point the pumping houses caught fire and all the water stopped running, and anybody who was trying to put the fire out suddenly discovered they had no water. The fireproof buildings, for instance, and they did have one that was very famous, unfortunately had a wooden roof. It caught fire and burned from the inside.
Wow.
And so it was, you know, a city that said, oh, we're prepared for any disaster, but clearly they weren't. And I thought, you know, that's something that kids should actually hear about, because then they could think about their own town and what, you know, there's all these safety measures in place, but which ones will really work when the time comes? And then you just had the thing of, once the city burned, you know, who's going to move back in? And the weird part is the prices of the land actually went up after all the buildings burned.
Yeah.
So it became hard for ordinary people to come back and build. They changed the building codes and made it harder for people just to build houses. So the poorer people had to move away.
Into
the
slums.
People were able to stay.
Yeah, into the slums, and you have immigration issues and all the social issues that surrounded this fire as people who did lose their housing blamed others.
Right. And I, you know, what I wanted to do was take a theme that's a little unusual. And as you said, you know, it might get a line or two in a history book. Most of them don't even have mentioned the Chicago fire, but make it something where, you know, kids can learn valuable lessons that are just as important as the ones that are in their textbooks. And also just the way I, you know, hopefully the way I write my books is a lot more lively and involving than, say, a textbook, a standard textbook, which is lots and lots of facts and information. And there's a place for that, except I just figured, well, why don't I do something different? Because there are people who can do that better than I can, so I'll just do something different.
My guest today is Jim Murphy, author specializing in history and historical fiction, a two-time Newbery Honor Book winner, and the winner of this year's ANVZERO Award for Young Readers Literature. He'll be accepting the award Friday evening at 7 o'clock at Gilchrist Museum, a big change this year, not Central Library, then speaking Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at Hardesty Regional Library, and signing books as well. He's the author of a number of really fine historically based young adult books and children's books. I want to talk about one that's probably the one you get asked about a lot, and that's The Long Road to Gettysburg, which is the 150th anniversary this past summer. And it's telling the story through the eyes of a Confederate lieutenant, John Dooley, and a Union corporal, Thomas Galway. I notice both are Irishmen, but it is a fascinating story because you see it from their own personal journals, as well as telling the whole story of the lead up to the battle, as well as the battle and the bigger issues that were happening at the time at Gettysburg. It's a good history because it does go from the very beginning past the battle, yet it's also personal because of these personal narratives.
Well, that book came about. I actually wanted to write a book about Abraham Lincoln, and a good friend of mine wrote a very definitive children's book. His name is Russell Friedman, and you know, his book was a photo biography of Lincoln. It won the Newbery. And so I was just sort of poking around, studying things about Lincoln and not knowing what to do with it. And then along the way, I wrote a book called The Boys' War, which was about boys who were 16 years old and younger who fought in the Civil War. And they were, of course, they were underage. And that book was very interesting because, you know, I was able to I put a book together that actually no one had ever written before. There were no books about underage soldiers in the Civil War. And so then I had Galway was in there in that book because he enlisted when he was 15, but Dooley didn't make it because he was older.
Mm-hmm.
And something about both of their firsthand accounts kind of stuck in my head and I wasn't sure. So after The Boys War was published, and here's where dumb luck comes into my career a great deal. The Boys War was published the same week that Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War first aired. And so anywhere Ken Burns' big, massive Civil War book was, my book was right there next to it. And so my friends were calling from all around the United States saying, Ken Burns has 100 books in the window of the bookstore, and you have two, but that's pretty good. and I was so happy. I said, I'll ride anybody's coattails. This is fun. But then what happened is a number of months went by, and I kept thinking about Galway and Dooley and why something about their narratives stuck in my head. And I went back and reread. They both had books published. And I went back and reread them and discovered that they describe, on the day of Pickett's charge, the same clump of trees. And then what I did is I took both of their companies, I found a map of Gettysburg, and I very carefully followed exactly where both of their companies were during Gettysburg and trailed them, because they moved around the countryside from here to there to there. And I discovered that on the day of Pickett's charge, Galway was in something called an advance picket. So he was down about 100 yards away from the front of the Union line with about 7 or 8 other Union soldiers. And Dooley was part of a Virginia group that charged across, and they probably came within about 100 feet of each other at one point. And I know that, or I feel that, because Dooley describes coming across the big valley, and I don't know if you've ever been at Gettysburg, but there's a huge
valley.
And when you're halfway across, you have to go uphill toward where the Union lines were, and it's pretty daunting. He describes his company coming up and seeing an advance picket just in front of the clump of trees and having to wheel to the right to go around them. They decided not to bother with that small group of Union soldiers. Their aim was to get to the Union cannons. And Galway was in that advanced picket. And I just thought, this is just completely phenomenal that I figured this out. And then I decided, I'm going to follow these two boys from the moment they start marching to Gettysburg and follow them through their 3 days at Gettysburg and what happens to them afterwards. So that's how that book sort of came together. It took about a year to piece together the information for them. And then just in the writing of the book, I don't have enough space. In a children's book, you have very limited space. And I decided that instead of trying to tell every bit of this history of Gettysburg, I would hit on what I considered to be the big turning points. And so there are about 4 or 5 of them that I discuss. And they all change the way the battle went and the outcome. So it's sort of telling kids, you know, there are big moments that change everything in life.
And they may not necessarily seem like big moments at the time of the decision. It's just instinctively the right thing to do, and it ends up being the linchpin, if you will.
Well, what I discovered is I put together a number of books that are all based on the important moments that changed history. Again, I was not part of this movement, but I was reading a book by James McPherson, and he's discussing something called historical contingency and how there's a lot of historians who essentially look for the turning points in history, and that's how they do their research. And I realized, oh my goodness, I've been kind of doing this for 20 years and didn't even know I'm part of a movement. But now I have a fancy name to put to it.
Historical
it's a turning point. But you know, contingency, it also applies, by the way, to biology and to all sorts of studies. It's essentially saying, you know, it's not just that very important people are making big decisions and saying, guess what, we're going to go to war and we're going to have a battle and here is where it's going to happen. The idea of contingency is these things are not planned that carefully. They often happen by sheer luck, chance, bad luck. You know, something bizarre happens. For instance, I wrote a book about the Battle of Antietam, and, you know, that battle hinges completely around the fact that a corporal marching with his company wandered off the road, sat down, leaned back against the fence because he was exhausted, put his hand out, and he hit a packet of letters. And actually what happened is he opened them up and discovered that there were some cigars in there, and he and his friend started smoking a cigar, and they looked at the one document that was there and discovered that it was Robert E. Lee's orders to his top generals, and they knew exactly where Robert E. Lee was going to move his troops just from that letter. And that letter went up the chain of command, and, you know, the Union commander, who was really slow about moving usually, decided, wow, now we know what this guy's up to. Let's actually engage him. So that one little find meant that Antietam happened where it did.
My guest today is Jim Murphy, author of numerous books of history and historical fiction. He's the winner of this year's ANV Zero Award for Young Readers Literature. He'll be accepting the award Friday evening at 7 o'clock at Gilchrist Museum and speaking Saturday morning at 10 at the Hardesty South Regional Library. In his books, there are several on the Civil War. There's a number on the colonial period from Washington's Crossing the Delaware to journals of kids during the Revolutionary time, several books on westward expansion, but and disasters as well, like the Great Blizzard and the Great Fire, which we talked about earlier. And it's really interesting. As far as picking a subject that you think is going to make a book, what is your process?
Usually, dumb luck plays a good part in how I figure out what to do. I'm a voracious reader. I love to read. I'd rather do that than write. The actual writing process I find very painful, and every day I go downstairs with a headache. But I love doing research, and out of the research, ideas sort of come to me, and the books start building themselves. But a lot of it is just silliness. I mentioned a book before called The Boys' War. Mm-hmm. That came about because I was at the Newark Library, a great old library, and I was doing research on something else, and I saw a book on a big research table just sitting there, and it was there all day. So in the afternoon, I said, you know, I'm going to help them out. They're very underfunded over at this library. And I picked the book up, and I went searching in the stacks to find out exactly where it went. I was going to reshelf it for them. And I got to exactly the place. I even found the space in the book. And then I glanced, I figured, okay, what book am I putting back? And I realized it was called Elijah Stockwell Jr. Sees the Civil War. And I went, oh, okay, I don't know that too much about the Civil War. And then I started to look at the introduction, and it said that he was 15 years old when he signed up to fight in the Civil War, not to be a drummer and, you know, or anything like that. And my first thought was, gee, I didn't know kids that young fought in the Civil War, at which point I realized, oh, my goodness, that's an idea. And I took that book out, and I realized, you know, pretty quickly that there were no books about underage soldiers. So I had to do all of that research, but I just spent, I don't know, 5 years trying to figure out how many other voices I could find, because I wanted voices, and I wanted the voices to carry the narrative forward. So that's how that book came about.
I was struck by another book that you wrote about the immigrant experience, Across America on an Immigrant Train. The basis is Robert Louis Stevenson, I guess, recounting his trip all the way across the United States to San Francisco on, I think it was about 1879, visiting his ailing fiance, and used that as a backdrop for the whole westward migration. He probably was in relative comfort, but there were, you know, numerous immigrants in cramped, horrible conditions, but they were all, you know, they were all looking for that dream. And then, you know, on the other hand, you have the Native Americans who are watching their lands disappear, the buffalo disappear. And you tell that whole story through this trip of Robert Louis Stevenson.
Well, first, you know, that book came about because, and I'm not a big collector of things, but my wife loves to go to antique stores, markets and flea markets and anything like that. And I discovered, and we've been married for a long time, and I discovered that one way to cope was to go over where they have postcards and to look through postcards, because it can take hours. And I began collecting postcards of trains. So I have several hundred of these really pretty postcards, most in full color, that feature railroad car, you know, railroads of some sort. And one day I was looking at them thinking, you know, I wondered if I could put a book together using these postcards to illustrate. And then I said, well, what are you going to say? And I began doing some reading. And then I came across Robert Louis Stevenson's journey. And far from being a pampered traveler, he actually had a miserable trip. He had very little money. He had to borrow money. He was in Scotland when he heard that his, you know, beloved was ill and possibly dying. And he had to borrow money, and he went on a tramp steamer and did not have the best facilities. But when he got to the United States, he took the lowest, cheapest fare he could to get across country. And he had a miserable time. And by the time he got to California, as you probably know, he had tuberculosis, and it had come back raging strong, and he was closer to death than she was. She actually had to, you know, care for him and bring him back to health. But I just found his experience fascinating, and because he just saw so much, and he was this interested observer, and so he could, you know, he saw the Chinese workers, for instance, and he was fascinated because they were doing these strange things like taking showers and baths every day. They ate a very simple diet that seemed to make them happy. They weren't drinking a lot, and he was just fascinated by that. And so essentially, he was helping to do the narration for me, and then I decided, well, I better build on this. There's more to this trip than just what he sees. Also, I decided I kind of wanted to really engage boys. So I realized, you know, I have to talk about train wrecks because soldiers love the notion of how many trains crashed back then. I mean, it really, they were just falling off the tracks all the time because when they built the Transcontinental Railroad, you know, there was a competition to see who could build it the fastest. And these companies were making a great deal of money on how much they built every day. And a lot of these, the rails that were put down were just horribly done. And they were falling apart left and right. And then trains just ran into each other all the time. And so I thought, well, I'm not trying to have fun with this, but I think kids will be fascinated by how dangerous something like train travel was. And so, yes, I just kept building on it as much as I could to add different themes and different topics so that as the reader is traveling west, they're seeing what's happening out there in the big country when it was, you know, in a much more primitive state.
Jim Murphy, I know your motto is making history come alive, and you certainly have done that in your many books. And congratulations again on the Zara Award, and thanks for joining us.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to being out there and having a good time.
Jim Murphy is a two-time Newbery Honor Book winner, specializing in history and historical fiction, and the winner of this year's ANVZERA Award for Young Readers Literature. He'll be accepting the award Friday evening at 7 o'clock at Gilcrease Museum and signing books, and speaking Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at Hardesty Regional Library. Both are free and open to the public. Information at TulsaLibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.